Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Wintering Sessions, the podcast in which writers talk about the cold seasons in their lives, periods of isolation, rejection and loss, and tell us what they learned. Today I'm talking to Rebecca Armstrong, a journalist and features editor at the iNewspaper, and an all-round brilliant human being. Hi Rebecca.
Hi Catherine.
It's lovely to talk to you.
Really great to talk to you. I really, really enjoyed wintering and found a lot there that really resonated with me. So I'm thrilled to be having a chat.
Yeah, and that's how we got to know each other, isn't it? We got into a conversation about those wintering periods and met for a cup of tea, which is really rare for me. I'm normally really resistant to meeting to cups of tea.
I feel very honoured.
I had a feeling we'd get on. I am delighted that you agreed to talk to me because our conversation centered around the big changes that have happened in your life, and I just thought how amazing it would be for you to share what had happened with a wider audience than just me over a cuppa.
Sure.
Because, well, to dive straight in, you stopped drinking last year.
That's right. So I am now about 8.5 months sober.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And I think if you had said to me this time last year that I would be, you know, happily not drinking, you know, actively not drinking, I think I would have been very surprised. Enjoying a drink, being a bit wild after a drink was very much part of my personality.
Right.
You know, it's something that over the years I had spent some time thinking about, and I keep finding old notebooks, and in the beginning of them, sort of lists of pros and cons of drinking and lists of sort of addiction memoirs. So it was obviously something that I was.
So it had gone round your mind for a long time, but
yeah, it had, you know, and you know, I'd done. you know, a few years back, I did sort of, you know, a November without drinking.
Oh, yeah.
As a teenager, you know, from the ages of 17 to 18, I didn't drink, which to me at the time, you know, just, it, you know, I had my reasons. And actually recently I've been thinking about that more and more, about obviously there was something then that I saw about, you know, how I drank sometimes that wasn't very helpful. And you know, later on I didn't, you know, alcohol used to make me feel really unwell and I didn't really drink very much. And I felt so furious when I was sort of in my early 20s. You know, so it felt like my right to be able to sort of have a few drinks and then have a few more. And I remember increasingly sort of thinking, what do people do when they don't have a drink?
Yeah.
You know, and sort of looking at how I would, you know, just sort of not necessarily plan my days around having a drink, but that would always be sort of a high point.
Yeah.
You know, and if I had a day off, it would be, you know, a really nice thing to go and, you know, sit in the pub. I really liked going to the pub. I really enjoyed going to the pub.
Pubs are nice places, right? I mean, they're not necessarily evil places, are they? They're
not at all. Not at all. But
social life happens, and I think that must make it very hard.
Absolutely. I mean, and also, I very much, you know, I very much used to use, you know, alcohol for me. It was lots of different things. It was like a magic potion, you know. It was like you sort of uncork the magic potion and, you know, and have a drink, and then what's going to happen? Who are you going to meet? Where are you going to go? What are you going to talk about? You know,
I relate to that so strongly. Funnily enough, I've been writing about that recently. Thinking about how perhaps when you're a teenager and you start drinking, alcohol is that kind of almost magic gateway.
Yeah.
That brings about adventures. You know, it's this, you take the potion and everything changes and everyone becomes disinhibited and you don't know what's going to happen. And so you drink to open up that potential of the evening.
Absolutely. You know, and also, you know, I mean, I think of myself, you know, there are obviously moments in my life when I'm not confident, but usually I would think that I'm quite a sociable person. I'm quite confident. But what has been really interesting over the past few months is sort of examining how much I used alcohol as Dutch courage.
Yeah.
You know, as a magic potion to sort of, you know, as a catalyst, as you know, sort of liquid bravery.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a way of sort of maybe making things that I didn't think were very fun more fun.
We've all been there.
Which kind of begs the question, why are you doing the thing in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, people often talk about the journalistic culture of drinking, which hopefully is reforming a bit as we go through time, but maybe not as much as we might hope.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, there are after-work drinks and there are leaving parties, you know. But I think what's really interesting is once I'd decided to, you know, to stop drinking, I, as a little exercise to myself, went through my email inbox of all the invitations that I'm lucky enough to get for events and launches and, you know, book parties and all sorts. And I mean, And I remember looking in the run-up to Christmas, so obviously that's a particular time when socialising and alcohol are really on the agenda. But I mean, I could probably have gone to drinks events three or four times a night for, you know.
Three or four times a night?
Yeah, I mean, I would get so many invitations.
That would kill me.
I mean, I wouldn't go and do that, but in terms of invitations, you know, just, you know, there's so many things. And, you know, and actually, you know, the prospect of a free bar was always quite appealing. Or, you know, a cocktail workshop. You know.
We never grow out of that excitement at the prospect of a freebie, do we? I think.
I know. You know.
Free food, free alcohol, they always seem very, very appealing somehow.
Yes. And, you know, and so that, but I think, yeah, I mean, I think partly that that kind of permission, you know, I mean, obviously I'd like to point out now, you know, wasn't sitting at work sort of, you know, sipping from a hip flask. And, you know, and these were sort of, you know, social events with sort of work thrown in, or work events with socialising thrown in. But I think, you know, looking back, I can really see times when I realised that I wasn't really drinking like other people.
Right. And what did you that know, look like for you? What was that particular experience?
So I guess firstly, the lure of free drinks to go to a thing. You know, that was a big, like, ooh, interesting. Okay, great. Let's do that. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I remember going to a very, you know, very lucky enough to, you know, I work a lot with publishers and authors in my job. And, you know, get invited to some really, like, really wonderful dinners. You know, I've been to publishing dinners where, you know, there are fantastic speakers. You know, there's authors with books coming out. There's really great, you know, publishing people, great publicists. The sort of events that, you know, were I a teenager to look at what I was doing, I would be like, oh my God, this is amazing. And it is. I love reading. I love books. You know, I feel very privileged that this is part of my job, and to go to these very, you know, these beautiful, beautiful spaces that have been set up for dinners to, you know, to showcase writers and what titles are coming out.
Those publishing showcases are so glamorous. I rarely get to go to them, but when I have been, I am always so impressed by them, and I always come away with a hangover, actually.
Yeah, and it feels, you know, you feel part of a privileged club. You're getting to talk to these people. You know, I remember going to one, you know, with William Dalrymple there, you know, and I remember years ago reading From the Holy Mountain, and I think it's just the most brilliant book, and, you know, just to be sort of rubbing shoulders and having a chat, and, you know, and you know, they're important for work. They're you know, huge fun and important for work.
Yeah.
But, you know, one that I went to, I went on my own, which is fine. I'm fine going on my own to things. Absolutely fine, you know. And then I was pretty much sort of swept out as the last woman there. You know, it was a really nice restaurant that had been set aside for the event, and lovely, lovely drinks. And, you know, I wasn't sort of fighting or snarling, but, you know, it was an absolutely, you know, fabulous, chic dinner, really great. You know, really great authors. Towards the end of the evening, we'd had these amazing sort of sharing plates of really delicious food, and you know, the dessert was this huge kind of platter of pavlova. It was gorgeous.
Amazing.
I think it had rhubarb, and it was sort of pink, and it was so beautiful. And me, you know, Dutch couraged up and feeling sort of fairly larky, I realised I had sort of a Tupperware box with me. So I was like, oh, I'm going to take some of this. I mean, it's just going to go to waste, isn't it? So there I am with these authors sort of, you know, playing the sort of the cheeky, larky features editor, sort of, you know, swiping pavlova for the next day and getting chatting to the staff and, you know, oh, just, you know, being given hot cross buns that were part of the bakery of the restaurant,
right,
and generally sort of feeling like I was sort of jolly good fun. And then, you know, looking back now, I just think I cringe.
Wow.
You know, because I can perpetuate a larger than life character, and I can sort of play up to that. But I think I lost any sense of sort of nuance.
Right.
When I was drinking. And that's not, you know, that's not a story where it's like, oh my God, it was awful. And then
I destroyed my life. I destroyed everything around me.
Punch the barman and, you know, steal someone's necklace and end up, you know, in the gutter, you know, with my knickers around my ankles.
Just to say I'm here for those stories.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, that's not, you know, that's just not this story. You know, and I think as well, at so many things, you know, at weddings, at funerals, it was always sort of looking out for where the drink was coming from.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took me quite a long time to realise that people were not motivated to get on it in the same way that I was.
Right, right.
You know, and also, you know, I've sort of had sort of drier periods and you know, wetter periods of drinking, but you know, it's something that I've written about in my own journalism before. 6 years ago, somebody very close to me had a life-changing car accident. My husband was knocked down and subsequently was in a coma and now lives in residential care. And, you know, that's a long story that I've told many times. But the past 6 years since that were a big catalyst for me and my drinking.
Oh, I mean, I can only imagine how you must have felt the need to escape sometimes.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. You know, I'd work very hard sort of in the day job, then very hard on the sort of the life admin and the care admin and that and the worry. And so it got to a point where the only time I really felt that I could relax was, you know, with a glass in my hand, and it was seldom one glass, and it was absolutely anesthetic.
Yeah, you know, kind of puts a full stop. I think I said in wintering how there were moments when I was in my full-time job that I would have a drink at the end of the day to kind of render myself incapable. It was almost like a punctuation mark that said, you can't possibly expect me to answer emails now, guys. I'm drunk, sorry. You know, and I really recognise that need to deliberately put yourself out of the game sometimes, almost.
Yeah. You know, like, this is my time. This is my, you know, this is my time to seek oblivion. I've spent all day worrying about other people and worrying about, you know, keeping a household running and running a legal case and doing battle with social services and so the punctuation, the sort of, you know, the new paragraph was one, you know, that was sort of typeset in booze. You know, and it sort of came to a head last summer. You know, there's lots of, I'd been, you know, there's a saying in recovery, which is, my life had become unmanageable. And that is a saying used in conjunction with drinking. But actually, drinking was part of it, but I had managed to sort of cobble together an unmanageable life. You know, the things that were beyond my control, I'd tried to control in a certain way, and I'd done my absolute best for a long time. And, you know, using alcohol as an anaesthetic, and, you know, using it as a treat, and, you know, it was very much a part of my life. And it got to a point where I realised that everything in my life was unmanageable. I could not manage it. It was beyond me. And
that's a huge moment, isn't it? That
sense that
everything is not something you can deal with anymore.
Yeah, and I was due to so this would have been, this was sort of, you know, September last year. I was due to go away on a real journo jolly. I'm not, you know, let's not. I was not being sent to the front line. I was going to go to Abu Dhabi on a press trip to write, and then I was going to go and visit some friends afterwards who live out there. And, you know, despite the fact that Abu Dhabi is not a country you might necessarily associate with drinking, you know, press trips, you know, travel trips in my line of work, you know, if you're lucky, you see beautiful places. It's a real privilege to go, but there is quite a heavy drinking in the evenings culture. And, you know, obviously, as we've discussed, that was a culture that I sought out, and, you know, hanging out with new sort of contacts, and, you know, there's something about certain press trips that it's a bit like being on like the best school trip you can imagine, but you're a grown up and there's booze, and it's normally quite glamorous locale, so you can imagine that it doesn't lend itself well to sort of
sobriety
and good sense. And so this trip was coming up, and there was a lot going on, you know, in my life sort of beyond work, and I just, it's almost like my body was just like, no.
Wow.
My mind was like, no, you can't do this. No.
So, you know, something kind of behind something, your
something,
consciousness,
something,
you know.
just sort of firmly sort of shut the door. Was like, no, you're not doing that, you know. And I see a therapist who is fantastic.
Were you already seeing the therapist at that point?
Yeah, I've seen her. I've seen her for a few years, and I remember saying to her, I don't think I can go on this trip. You know, it's just too alarming, and I don't want to I don't want to do this. I know how it will pan out. And she just said, so, you know, what happens if you don't go? Mm. And I realised that I had to email 3 people. My editor for this particular trip, the PR person who was organising it, and my friends, and just say, I'm really sorry.
Just can't.
I can't make this trip. And that was it. That was 3 emails that I had to send. And
it's so interesting to me that what you had there was like the decision was made and then your job was to work out how and why you'd made the decision rather than, and I think that's such a truth about how life happens to us quite often. We're not in control of it. It happens to us and we have to interpret it afterwards.
Yes, and you know, and then, you know, so I had this, you know, I had this time, I had this week when I was meant to be, you know, away, and I lived for, you know, and I spent it quite quietly, and I went to the seaside. I went to stay on my own in a friend's place in Margate and look after her cat. And then I went to stay with my best friend in Broadstairs. And I had a couple of days, you know, by the sea, mugging around. I remember in Margate, I went to like a real old school pub, just sat doing some embroidery, drinking some booze. You know, I mean, I really love I've always loved the sort of the sitting around in pubs, talking to the regulars, finding out what the jokes are, who's doing what, that's the darts team, what's the vibe. You know, the real pub connoisseur, really. Oh, yeah. Loved, you know, just even a shit pub I loved because it was a pub.
Deep pub. Yeah.
You know, and sort of went back to my friend's house and sort of sat there. And I woke up at about 3 o'clock in the morning, really just sort of just thinking, oh, this again?
Mm.
You know, and the next day I went to see a friend. I went to see my best friend. And again, we had, you know, a really lovely evening. We sort of shared a bottle of wine, a couple of gin and tonics. There was no sort of rock bottom.
No.
It wasn't like, you know, I woke up sort of having, you know, abducted a policeman, you know, wearing a cat on my head. You know, there's no sort of absolute, I mean, there had been chaos, but there was no, you know, there's no sort of, this is it, that's it. But you know, I woke up, you know, again at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I just thought to myself, I think this might be it for a while.
You were just done.
Just kind of done, yeah. And, you know, it's funny because I've always dreaded winter. I've always found winter, like, really, really hard. You know, I'm sort of, I find, you know, I find that the darkness really hard, I think. And I feel really resentful that it gets dark. You know, I can deal with cold, but dark, you know, and I'm very resentful as a woman that basically my world gets smaller during the winter. You know, there are places I can't go. There's places where I don't feel safe, you know, and so I really, winter, really not, you know.
Not your favourite season.
Not my favourite season at all. And so, you know, suddenly sort of deciding, in autumn that, you know, probably wasn't going to drink for a while. That was my thinking. You know, it was, I suppose, a bit of a back to school feeling, like kind of a bit sensible. But actually, I must say that sober October, you know, which has the benefit of having a better name than Dry January, which doesn't sound like anything, but like Sober October
I just think Dry January is the last point in the calendar. I know. Or, you know, anyway, I just...
October or whatever. Ooh, so actually I found that quite good cover because, you know, I could just sort of say, well, I'm doing Sober October. I'm just going to see how that goes. I mean, I don't think I'd decided at that point that I wanted to really call it a day. Mm. You know, I spoke to a friend of mine who I knew was sober, and she, you know, really sort of stepped up and was hugely supportive.
Yeah.
But yeah, being able to sort of, you know, meet new people and not be drinking, and for it to just be like, oh yeah, well I'm doing Sober October. It was sort of like
it was like a gateway, I suppose. I
mean, it strikes me
that one of the hard things is that about giving up would be all of the questions, you know, and that gives you some cover, doesn't it? You just go, oh, I'm just doing Sober October.
Exactly. And it also, you know, it's also sort of gave me cover from myself.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that I could sort of say to myself, well, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to see, you know, see how this goes. But that was really, really a useful thing, because it wasn't like I had to say to everybody, well, I think I've got a drink problem.
Right.
You know, well, actually, I think this thing that has taken up a bigger and bigger and bigger part of my life is actually, it's not helping me float. It's drowning me. So being able to say, well, I think I might do Sober October. Oh, well, actually, it's going quite well. I think I might extend it for a couple of months. And then by the time you're sort of 3 months in, I think, well, for me, I felt more confident.
Yeah, about... 3 months is a big chunk of the year, isn't it? That feels like a change then, doesn't it? 3 months.
Yeah. And, you know, that, interestingly, you know, probably around that time I read your book, and I found that both the concept of wintering absolutely true. You know, it was just such truth about, oh, you know, us
it's
having...
It's really nice to know that it landed at a moment when you needed
it. Oh,
it really
did.
Delighted by that.
You know, the sort of fallow periods in our lives, and then but that we need them, you know, and that there are different ways to approach, you know, a season both sort of emotional but also in the calendar sense, and appreciate that. So, you know, whereas, you know, in previous Christmases, say, you know, you'd find me sort of with a pint of Baileys and, you know, very much sort of throwing myself into the Christmas spirit, but also using alcohol to get through it. You know, it has been a really rough few years. I've had quite a rough few years, and it felt for a long time that alcohol helped. I wouldn't say that alcohol caused all of my problems, but it certainly was present. The thought of Christmas sober and how I would play it with family who drink and with friends. Yeah, it was a challenge, but it was one that actually I started to relish.
Sometimes when you're ready to, when you're really ready to confront that challenge, then it becomes weirdly okay. I mean, not that it's obviously not hard. How did your family react? Did you get a lot of comments or...?
So I think that my dad was... I think he was just sort of, you know, whatever worked for me.
Right.
You know, I mean, he'd joke a bit because, he sort of seen me in full flight having, you know, having drinks. And he's like, oh, God, you are a bit of a loony. I think that for maybe other members of my family, they sort of thought it was, you know, a temporary thing. But I found having my drink, so having my ginger beer, I got completely obsessed with ginger beer and having my drink. And actually, I'd really look forward to it.
Good ginger beer out there. It has to be.
Yeah,
said.
And I think I'm really surprised at, you know, and with the caveat that, you know, every new day is a new day, you know, and I aim to not drink today. I take it a day at a time. But, you know, surprisingly quickly, I didn't feel the daily craving for alcohol that had been such a part of my life, you know, up until giving up. I mean, it took a while, but I was so surprised that it sort of, it loosened its grip on me. And yeah, being able to have, like, you know, a delicious ginger beer. I mean, if you'd have said that to me a year ago, I'd have been like,
yeah, whatever.
Piss off.
Yeah.
You know, and equally finding, you know, non-alcoholic spirits, you know, there's a great one called Acorn. Again, I'd have been like, what is the point of that? You spent how much on some water? But actually, I find that having something that's quite a ritual, quite a special drink, I like the sense of sense of occasion,
ceremony.
The treatiness of it.
And when you think about the number of times we're willing to drink truly terrible tasting alcohol for the sake of drinking alcohol,
I remember if you flip
that over, it's actually quite shocking.
I remember a few years ago, you know, I was away with some friends, and we'd drunk everything, and we ended the night, you know, sort of drinking, you know, Bacardi with not quite cold water. Because that was all that was left to drink.
Wow, that is, that's not a pleasant drink.
No, you know, and just, and I think of all the book launches that I went to that weren't quite as lavish, where, you know, I'd just be sort of drinking, like, I mean, again, Diamond Shoes are too tight, you know, it was free, but, you know, I never liked Sauvignon Blanc, but I'd bloody get outside some of that if it was free. I mean, and oh God, the nights when I'd, at the end of events, be like, oh, those bottles of wine going spare, oh God, and I'd go home. Sort of with, like, I'd managed to acquire like three sort of orphan bottles of wine to take home with me. I'm actually putting my head in my hands thinking about this. And, you know, sometimes I take home sort of a few bottles of, you know, purloined wine, and then sometimes I'd be like, come all back to mine, and like various random people in, oh
wow,
God,
you're the life and
back
soul.
At my house, oh God.
I mean, I often think a lot about my drinking, because I do enjoy drinking, and there was a period of time after my son was born when I was definitely drinking too much, and I remember getting to the point where I woke up on Saturday morning and my eyeballs had turned slightly yellow, and I just thought, whoa, that is not good. And I really knocked it on the head after that. But for me, that was part of realising a pattern of social behaviour that really, when I got to the bottom of it, I was spending too much time with other people, and it was more than I could cope with. And I had to drink to cope. I was overwhelmed. Yeah. I was completely overwhelmed. Yeah. And so actually the answer for me was just not to do that. And I think there's probably a load of people who are very hurt by my behaviour for walking away from their whole social scene. But my thing was always, you know, like, have everyone around the house, cook a pile of food for everybody, cook for everybody's children, mixing everyone a drink. And it was actually...
Sounds exhausting.
It was really exhausting. And I'd have to be cooking so I could be in the kitchen so I was away from everybody else.
Yeah.
But it was also like about trying to be generous and trying to be popular and feel wanted. Yeah. And not feel like my life had slipped down the drain after having a child. But
the
revelation for me was really like, wow, I'm literally hurting myself with alcohol in order to cope with the social life I've made for myself that I'm not enjoying.
You know, I think I wanted to, you know, in trying to manage an unmanageable situation, you know, with hospitals and then care homes and all this, I think that was hugely overwhelming. And I think I wanted to sort of try and prove that I was still fun and that I was still, you know,
you must have felt prematurely aged by that, you know?
Right, I mean, some days I felt 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
And other days I just felt like a really confused child, like, oh my God, how is this my life?
Yeah.
What do I do? And, you know, and I really feel that I have stripped a lot of stuff back. And by not drinking, it has, you know, I mean, by not drinking, you really have to have a look at what the drinking was covering up. I mean, you take away a lot of the chaos that the drinking caused, that my drinking caused me. But, you know, that chaos probably masked quite a lot of feelings, you know, and so actually learning sort of to sit and look at how you're feeling and feel how you're feeling is quite hard. You know, there's no wonder I was quite happy to sort of, you know, having Bacardi and water, because it's hard.
In fact, there are a few things harder than what you went through, and you masked all those smaller chaoses with one great big flamboyant chaos. And that's really forgivable, I think, as a strategy. Know, it's just not sustainable.
And, you know, and you know, I'll be honest, that, you know, it is not my, you know, alcohol was in my life a long time before the accident happened. You know, I have got a collection of things that I have managed to acquire in pubs when people have given them to me, or things I've swapped. You know, I don't think that, you know, it's like, oh yes, here's the amber necklace that some women randomly gave me at a thing. Or here's another thing that someone gave me. Here's a hat that I, you know, I mean, just a lot of pub chaos.
A
lot
of pub
kind
magpie.
Of, basically, I was a pub magpie, like squawking away with my eye on shiny stuff. And, you know, and the other thing, you know, if I'm completely honest, is I grew up with, you know, with some people who probably also had a problematic relationship with alcohol at times. And I, you know, I'm not going to sort of name and shame, I got to a point where I realised that behaviour that made me so uncomfortable in other people, I had somehow with some sort of dissonance, sort of, it was okay if I was doing it. If I did it, it was different. Whereas if I was around people who, you know, who used alcohol in a certain way, I mean, I would feel the hairs rise on the back of my neck.
Wow.
And after a while, I began to realise that I couldn't hold those two things.
That's incredible.
At once. Yeah. You know, I could not, you know, I couldn't ignore how emotionally and physically I felt around certain people and yet go forth and pretty much do the same thing. It was like these two kind of tectonic plates of realisation and behaviour. It was like they were, you know, they're kind of moving apart.
But it's incredible how long we can let those tectonic plates grind together before we notice, isn't it?
And it's normal, you know, I mean, you know, drinking a lot or drinking is normal, you know, is normalised. Drinking a lot, I think particularly, you know, as we've said, you know, the industry I work in is not, you know, it does, if not encourage it, then it certainly condones a lot of drinking. And I'm not, you know, I'm really not judging anybody else here. This is my journey and my experience.
But you're far from the first journalist to say it either. Yeah. It's not exactly you're the lone voice here, you know.
No, but also, I mean, my big thing, you know, across work events, across sitting on my own, across family things, you know, I could never see the point in having one drink.
Right.
Mm. You know, it was never a drink.
Yeah. It was always one led to the other to the other.
Yeah, you know, what was the point of having a drink when you could have all of the drinks? You know, and that's not to say that every time I had a drink I was, you know, rip-snortingly drunk. But no. My goal, or even probably my unacknowledged goal, was like, more is better. One is nice, more is better.
Yeah.
Because
I think we still, this is my grand theory of my own drinking, is that I think I'm still trying to open up that doorway into wonder that it felt like when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I've realised as I've got older that it's just always disappointing, that it doesn't. Yeah. It opens no doorway because I'm still sitting in my own living room watching QI and it's, you know, in my pyjamas and I'm going to go to bed at 10 o'clock. You know?
It's amazing. You know, there's... I think the magic potion sort of imagery, you know, it's a bit like glamour. You know, it's a bit like the sort of the idea of the fairy glamour.
Glamour, yeah.
That you sort of see, you know, this beautiful world and it's like this, but actually you're eating ashes or, you know, you think that you're dancing with a fairy queen, but really it's, you know, it's something quite different. And yeah, just and learning that. And not just learning it as in... Oh yeah, of course, that's not as good. But sort of learning to feel that and to know it is really hard, you know. Yeah. And you know, I mainly feel relief. I feel relief, you know. I spent the dark winter months that normally are the months of mulled wine. They're the months of, you know, champagne at, you know, festive things. They're the months of Bloody Mary because you had a bit too much to drink last night at the thing. They're sort of like, oh, a bracing walk and then, oh, some pints in the pub and a roast dinner. They're, you know, Baileys. They're, you know, all of those things.
Dark spirits, you know, whiskey. Darks,
yeah, exactly, all of that,
Negronis,
you know.
And
actually, you know, I found this really... different side of winter. Being very on message with wintering, but actually winter
really
to me actually winter to me that had been so sort of bound up with, you know, with that sort of socializing, that sort of you know, Yule time, this sort of, you know, bonfires in the dark and fire water, yeah, just to learn that actually dark evenings were fine, because I'd get in and actually if I wasn't drinking, sometimes I was quite tired and I went to bed.
I get the sense you really learnt to take care of yourself in the months that followed.
And I read, you know, there's a fantastic book by the author Alan Jenkins called Morning, and it's a manifesto about how to sort of learn. It's not, I say it's learn to love mornings, that makes it sound like it's a self-help book, and it isn't. It's just a really beautiful account of somebody who likes getting up early in the morning, writing each day that he gets up what it's like and what he looks for and what he enjoys, and intersperse it through the book is talking to other sort of interesting and creative people about their relationship with early mornings.
Sounds
and
great. I must look that up. I'll put that in the
show
notes.
It's really, really good and beautiful. And I read it before and was like, oh yeah, I'm not going to set my alarm early to do that. No way. You know, I've got to need as much sleep as I can get because I'll feel rough as arses. But it obviously spoke to something in me. And actually over the winter, I started setting my alarm early. I started getting up at 6 and started giving myself time before work, because all of a sudden, like, evenings for me were a time when I was just really tired.
So you were feeling that for the first time. I mean, I'm lover of mornings, and I just think that silence in the morning is so much bigger than the silence at night. And
it is
that sense of intimacy and quiet and a snuck, this secret special time that nobody
else is amazing having. You know, and to get up and it was dark, you know, and everyone's like, oh, dark mornings, and I'd always be like, oh, dark mornings, and I would get up and I would light candles and I would do a bit of yoga, and I would call it stretching, because me and yoga over the years, I mean, I go back to it like a dog to its vomit, but I mean, there's not a lot of kind of zen, it's quite a grudging relationship.
I think stretches just sound so much more relaxed.
Stretches, you know, and listening to the radio and maybe doing some embroidery and just being just this whole new time. And the darkness was incredibly comforting. It was like velvet. It was like a dark velvet sort of nest.
Yeah.
And not feeling like absolute crap in the mornings, and not feeling, you know, I used to for years joke that what got me out of bed in the morning was coffee and fear. You know, those were the two things. It was only sort of terror at the thought that I'd lose my job and coffee that would sort of give me a kick up the arse. And actually, over the course of the winter, I actually gave up coffee for a while.
Wow, you had a revolution. Coffee and alcohol.
Just stopped taking it. Oh, there we go. There it is. You know, and then actually I decided to bring it back in, and I'd have a coffee a day.
Yeah.
But, you know, waking up, having a cup of tea, learning about this thing called breakfast that people eat.
yes, we do. Yep.
Yep. Yeah,
often twice
never managed to get my head around breakfast. But in these mornings, you know, like my little, it was a real sanctuary. And I'm not saying that I got up every single morning at 6, but it became something that I did and that I still do, you know. And now, you know, over...
It's very easy to do it in the summer, isn't it? Because the light can wake you up and...
You say that. I mean, I live in a basement flat, and so, you know, and I can
the light
sleep.
Doesn't penetrate.
I can sleep. I mean, I am very, very good at sleeping. I'm very grateful that I'm good at sleeping, but I do have to make an effort to sort of wake up. But in the summer, it's amazing. I have been getting up to see the dawn, and I think before I gave up drinking, I'd seen the dawn, as in I've got up to see the dawn twice in my life. Once was sort of years ago when I went to the Grand Canyon to go and like look at it at dawn.
Well, that's definitely worth it.
And another time when I went on a fitness retreat,
and they made you
years ago. Well, they didn't. Well, they made everyone get up. Well, everyone was getting up for a run, and it was the last morning. And I was like, I don't care. I'm not running anymore. And I sat and I looked, and I really sort of saw the dawn. But yeah, recently it's amazing. You know, it is amazing. I turned 40 a couple of weeks ago, and on my 40th birthday, I went to Parliament Hill in Hampstead Heath in North London, and you know, went to see the sunrise, and there were various people around, and some people were there with their dogs, and some people were there with their cameras, and there were some younglings who'd obviously been up all night on the bandstand sort of squawking. And there was, you know, there was this trio of you know, sort of bohemian hippie types with a bodhran drum and a very chic dog, and they were sort of singing, and my initial reaction was like, oh, for fuck's sake. But actually it was beautiful, yeah. And the song was beautiful, and the fact that we were all there to see the dawn, all in our own, you know, for our own reasons, and all there to see this thing that happens every day, this absolutely sort of amazing natural show, you know. And I thought, God, my life has really changed. And you know what, I am so happy and relieved.
It's so lovely that it has happened so gently for you, because obviously that's not true for everyone, and
no,
you know, but for you it seems like you just had your day with it and you were over it, and
yeah,
you've just found a different phase that is actually really nourishing and wonderful for you. I love
yeah
that.
And I, you know, and I feel really, really lucky, you know, because there were some, you know, I mean, I've lost count of the drunken injuries and the, like, you know, God, where did that bruise come from? Oh, God, how much did I spend? You know, there was a lot of chaos. Mm. And, you know, and touch wood, you know, today I'm not going to have a drink.
Yeah.
That's what's in, you know, that's what I can control today. I'd like to think that I won't have one tomorrow, but I'll deal with that when I come to it. And, you know, being in recovery, because, you know, I am part of a 12-step fellowship, mm. Which, you know, is so different to how I imagined it would be. You know, I feel very grateful and very lucky.
Well, I think it's just really great to hear you talk in just such an open and honest and shame-free way. I just got massive respect for that. So
oh,
I'll,
thank you.
I'll make sure I put all of your social links.
Yeah,
on,
do. You know, and I'm, you know, I really, you know, and there's so many fantastic, you know, women increasingly speaking out like it's a dirty secret, mm. you know, talking about their sobriety and what they get from it. And, you know, I'm really excited to have learnt from them. And to be sort of following in their footsteps, because, you know, there's enough heaping of shame, you yeah. know, and yeah, and I would never want to shame anybody for their drinking. And if it gets them through the night, you know, not absolutely go for it. But for me, it wasn't working anymore. And there are so many different ways of living.
Well, on that note, thank you yeah. so much, Rebecca.
My pleasure. Thank really you. Great to talk to you.
And that's all for this week's Wintering Sessions. Thanks so much to Rebecca Armstrong for telling her story so eloquently. If you enjoyed the podcast, please hit subscribe, give it some stars, or tell your friends, whatever your podcast app allows. I'll be back next week with another fantastic writer talking about their wintering experience.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.